My name is Hayes Carl. I'm from Houston, Texas. I currently reside in Nashville, Tennessee, and I am trying to be a singer-songwriter.
When you've put out, you know, almost what, 10 albums like you have at this point, is there a sense of dread or a sense of excitement when it's coming upon release day? Like, is there the fear that you're shouting in a forest and not enough people will hear you, or is it the gratitude that you can finally tell these stories and people will experience them?
Yeah, it's both. It's both. And that's part of the challenge for me is, on one hand, I've got this thing I'm very proud of and I want to put out into the world, and it's exciting. A record can, not only is it work that I want to share with people, but it affects your life. It affects your career, potentially, for the better or the worse. And there's an excitement to that, to see how the world embraces it, or if they even notice. So I'm excited to share music. But then there's the part of it that is anybody gonna notice? Am I worthy? So I try to stay out of that and just be grateful for what I've got.
I drove all the way to Tennessee to keep from looking at you. Constantly reminded of the damage love can do. Amped up like a junkie, praying for a little sleep. I tried every kind of medicine to purge you from my bloodstream.
Well, hey, everybody. Once again, you are tuned in to The Show on the Road. I'm Zach Lupitin, your humble audio scribe spirit guide, and I'm going to take you on a little ride with Mr. Hayes Carl today, if that's okay.
Goddamn the way I love you. Goddamn the way I love you.
Look, there's a lot of great music that comes out every year. Some songs just imprint themselves onto your brainstem, and you remember exactly where you were when you heard it the first time. Me and Hayes, we both share a common hero in Lucinda Williams. I remember the first time I heard her singing Righteously. I was driving my car back in my hometown of Evanston, Illinois. I actually pulled over and called the radio station. It's the only time I've ever done this. And I said, who is this voice? And if you haven't heard of Hayes Carl and his atmospheric country blues until this very moment, well, it is my job to inject just the right amount of his essence into your eardrums right now. Of course, unlike me, many of you wise souls may already have been listening to Hayes Carl all along. Indeed, next year marks the 20th anniversary of his first independent release, Flowers and Liquor. Back then, he was just a struggling college student in Arkansas, working at Chili's, hoping for a better life. Now let's stop and think for a second. How many folks working at Chili's, maybe working at Red Lobster like he did later on, are actually songwriters in disguise? Personally, instead of being drafted into the army, I think every American should work at least one long night at a food service job. I used to work the 5 p.m. to 4 a.m. shift at New York Pizza Depot in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and every night I would start to feel the atmosphere of the world change about 3 a.m. And it was walking in exhaustion through those foggy streets at about 4:30 a.m. that the best songs started hitting my brain. Does anyone feel like time has been moving differently in the last few years? Honestly, 2002, it doesn't seem like that long ago. And yet our minds were completely occupied by other things. We only spent 46 minutes a day on average on the internet. And if you wanted to buy music online, it took 12 and a half minutes to download a single song on a 56K modem. And yes, many things have changed in those 20 years. But through his earliest records, Flower and Liquor, Little Rock, Trouble in Mind, K-Mag Yo-Yo, Lovers and Leavers, What It Is, Alone Together, and You Get It All, his newest, which came out this year, you can see him as a writer and a lover of country music and a deeply observant student of the human condition, getting better and better at his craft. And while some Grammy-nominated artists may bring their wives into the studio for a cute cameo now and again, Carl is lucky enough to have an artist and very sought-after producer, Alison Moorer, on his home team. I think she really helped bring a softer, deeper side out of Carl for this newest record, and I'm so excited for you to hear it. Anyway, thanks for listening as always. December 4th, my group Dust Bowl Revival will be playing the Troubadour in LA. It's almost sold out, but without further ado, here he is now, Hayes Carl. I've only just started to dive into your work over the last month or so, believe it or not. And
I've toured with my own band for 10 years in this same field, and I've seen your name all over the place, but it was always like, well, you know, it's another guy from Texas kind of writing these really intense, you know, dark songs, and I hear it on the radio, and I just never jumped in. And now I'm like kind of obsessed. Like, it took me up until this week to finally get into some of your earliest work, because you put out records, you know, in 2002. I mean,
my first one was Flowers and Liquor in 2002.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. 2002, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like a different generation, it feels like. And that was one of the first self-produced records that went to the number one and on the Americana chart. And that's like something that is inspiring, I think, for a lot of songwriters like myself. This guy did it, and why not me? You know? Mm. How do you feel like you've changed as a songwriter from that first record to now?
Well, first of all, that's really cool to hear you say that, and I appreciate that. It's funny how fast time goes, because I remember that kid who just, the idea of being able to record my voice and my songs and something I created was the ultimate dream, fantasy.
You're making money, honey. You're gonna be a star. I lie around all day and play guitar. It's okay, it's okay. Everything gonna be alright. I make breakfast every morning, sing you lullabies at night.
Then for it to have any sort of success or to be able to make a career out of it was, you know, just beyond, at that point in my life, what I really thought was possible. So it's funny to look back, you know, I guess almost 20 years now, and see the road that I've traveled. You know, I remember trying to, first of all, I was just inspired by music. The joy that brought me and the way that it articulated my life, it helped me figure things out. It sold me. It just was everything to me. And so I just wanted to be a part of that. And so what I did was just studied the people I enjoyed. So I was just studying the Prines and the Dillons and the Christoffersons and the Lyle Lovett and the Kenny Rogers and the Jimmy Buffett and whatever the list. I mean, it goes on and on and on, but it sort of veered towards singer-songwriters because I had limitations vocally. It was sort of influenced by my limitations and also what I loved. But I, you know, I love Led Zeppelin, but I was never going to be Robert Plant. So it was like, okay, let's lean into, you know, John Prine. That seems achievable. Maybe not the songwriting part, but like some approximation of a folk singer. So I studied their stuff, and I started off trying to write, I think, like Townes Van Zandt. And I realized that I'm not Townes Van Zandt. It took me a minute and never will be.
Thank God you're still alive.
I'm still alive, and I have a pretty happy life. And but you know, that music meant so much to me, I wanted to be a part of it. And then it took me a while to figure out that the only thing that made me unique were the things that made me unique. And I needed to lean into those rather than try to be my heroes.
Close your eyes, I'll be here in the morning. Close your eyes, I'll be here for a while.
So that was the first big step, was just finding my own voice and my own point of view and feeling confident enough to put that out there. And then I went through a long stage where it was just all about stream of conscious for me, or connecting, just grabbing an idea, catching lightning in a bottle. And which is how I thought Dylan did it, or how Kerouac did it. And I just thought it was about, you know, drugs and drinking and capture this idea. And if I didn't get it in one swoop, I often just gave it up. It just didn't get done. And that wasn't always the case, but I mean, there were times where I sat down and spent a lot of time and effort on a song, but I was really just looking for that easy thing. And I had a little bit of aptitude, and it would happen every once in a while. I'd get lucky, but it was not a sustainable thing. And my focus wasn't really on the craft. And I think the biggest change in the last couple of years for me has been the interest in the craft. To me, that's the most fun part now. And I know going into a song that it's not going to be right the first time. that it's going to take editing, it's going to take reworking, it's going to take recording it and deciphering it and shaping it to be something that holds up and isn't dependent on my inflections or my vocal tone or the style of recording, that anybody can take the song and do something with it. And so that's been the biggest evolution for me, at least certainly of late.
It's interesting that you mentioned John Prine and Jimmy Buffett. Those are two songwriters that you wouldn't normally hear connected, but it actually works, I think, for your songwriting because of the humor that you have in a lot of your songs, the grin behind the like tears. I mean, look, the opening track of the new the new record, Nice Things, man, there's a lot going on there. Your very pinpoint observational skills are there.
God came down to earth and to enjoy what she created, took a fishing trip to Georgia to see what she could see.
But also you have the knack for a pop hook, right? That maybe took till now to really just embrace, you know? It's like all these things that this God, who's a lady, coming back to earth, just how hypocritical and violent and crazy we are as human beings with free will. And then realizing like, well, we can sum it up in one little tidy line.
Y'all can't have nice things.
We can't have nice things. Is it going to be a pop hit? Probably not. But like, why is Margaritaville a pop hit, right?
Yeah.
It's like a very melancholy song, Margaritaville, if you think about it.
I mean, I consider Buffett and Prine, it is the humor element, and that's a big turn on for me as a listener. I've always appreciated, you know, from Roger Miller to Todd Snyder or you know, even Dylan or the Stones. There's a lot of people that work humor into their stuff subversively or just outright. But to me, they're also storytellers. You know, Jimmy Buffett at heart, before he became a trillion-dollar corporation, you know, he's a storyteller. And he created, and I mean, he still is. I don't mean to disparage him, but it's much beyond that now. But those songs, particularly those early songs, created a time and a place, and they told stories of people traveling the world and of heartbreak and adventure. And it was, to me, that was magical as a teenager growing up in the suburbs, this idea of getting on a ship and going across the world and living in a life of adventure was, sign me up, you know, I'm
right.
I want that. And you know, another one that's big in that for me was really influential was Kenny Rogers. You know, again, probably people don't, a lot of folks don't cite him as an influence, but I mean, I was a fan, I just loved the voice, but the songs, to me, that was one of the first tapes I had, was this Greatest Hits cassette. And I was 7 or 8, and I would listen to these songs like The Gambler or Coward of the County or Lucille. And they had so much drama and they had everything. They were just mini movies, and some of them became movies. And I loved that. I felt this range of emotions. But with those songs, in particular, those Kenny ones, there was a hook. And I appreciate you mentioning that. You know, writing a hook has never been really my strength. Like I tend to write verses. I kind of write like I talk. I spend a lot of details, take a lot of time, and eventually get to my point.
This is why. This is why y'all can't have nice things. Oh, this is why y'all can't have nice things.
Well, you collaborated with a lot of interesting folks on this record. That song, Nice Things, with the Brothers Osborne. And again, mm-hmm. That song starts with the fiddle and the electric guitar. It could be on mainstream country radio at first, right? But when you have lines like, this is why I blessed you with compassion. This is why I gave you empathy, right? I don't hear lines like that or ideas like that on, you know, Country 105 Dallas. You know, it's like there's a lack of introspection or heart in a lot of the glossy modern country. And maybe that's why, you know, we're sort of put in this Americana world. You know, it's like more forward thinking, sensitive country music, but there's not a whole lot of, you know, hand holding in this song. It's pretty confrontational about just how messed up we are as humans, which is the best part of country music. It's like acknowledging our faults, right? Do you find that you identify yourself as a country music songwriter, or that you kind of forge your own path?
Well, both. I mean, I absolutely identify as a country musician and songwriter. It's a huge part of my influences and my style. But there's maybe it goes beyond that a little bit, and that there are other things that like I said, I'm a big Zeppelin fan, and Dylan is my you know, ultimate artist and songwriter, and was sort of the person that opened up this world to me and made me aware of what an effect music could have, not just as, oh, that's fun to sing, but it can change the world. So I tell people I'm a country folk singer songwriter, but yeah, I mean, I think this is the most country record I've ever made. And I wrote a lot of it with a lot of country artists like Brothers Osborne or Brandi Clark. And yeah, it's probably not going to get on the radio, but I don't think that's because it's not country. I just think it's, you know, there's a formula to a lot of that stuff, and it's really hard to get on the radio if you're not doing that stuff. So like I tried to get some of this pitched to country radio, and what they told me was it's a waste of your money, and it costs a lot of money to pitch songs to actual country radio. I've never done it before. I was curious. I said, why can't you get it all be on the radio? That's to me a pretty great country song. And they said, well, there's nothing else like it out there. And I thought, exactly. Like, that's exactly why this should be the thing, because rather than try and do the thing, there's already 100 of them. You know, it's going to be that thing that nobody's heard, or that's different than everything that's out there right now. That's going to break through in a big way at some point. And that may not be me, it may be, you know, somebody else, but that was Chris Stapleton. That was, you know, Jamie Johnson before that, or whatever. There are these things that nobody in a million years would go, oh, this is the country radio formula. And then somebody comes along and breaks the mold, and then everybody says, oh, well, we need more of that. We need more of that guy. So anyway, that's a different world, and one that I'm not really involved in. But I did look at this record and think, this is a country record, and with country elements and country themes, and written with a lot of country artists. And I thought, why not give that a shot? And I was quickly told that that's just not how it works. So I'm just gonna put it out to whoever will listen, and hope it finds an audience out there, regardless of genre.
If we go back to your first record, Flowers and Liquor, in 2002, you have a song like Easy Come, Easy Go that I love, that I think highlights, I think, your very specific skill of observing the tiny details of a changing world. You know, as maybe you're driving down the road, you see each story in each parking lot, in each liquor store, in each gas station, right? Do you remember where you were when you wrote that song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I was in college. I was 21, living in my apartment with my Croatian roommate and best friend in Conway, Arkansas. And I had a politics paper due the next day, and I stayed up all night trying to finish the paper. And I started that song, and I wrote it. And in the morning, I'd finished the song and the paper. I think the song's longer than the paper. And I certainly got a lot more mileage out of it. I remember it very well.
She'll be fine. Spent a lifetime walking through the walls of a broken home. Not a man around here still standing for the girl to call her on. Every time she tried to hold it, she just ended up alone. There's still time, there's still time.
And it was one of the first songs, maybe the third or fourth song that I ever finished that I played for somebody. And I remember a friend came over the next day and I said, hey, listen to this. And I played it and he's like, well, what happened there? And I said, well, I wrote it last night. He didn't believe me. And I took that as a good sign, you know, not to say that it's the end all be all of songs, but at that point in my life, trying completely uncertain whether I had any aptitude for this or ability to write something and feel good about it. And it encouraged me that there was, you know, to get some positive feedback encouraged me in a way that I needed to say, okay, maybe I've got a little something that I can use here. So yeah, I remember it well.
There's a lot of people running around, not quite sure which way to go. But as for me, well, I think I finally found, it's just easy come, easy go.
Remember your first official gig?
Yeah. I mean, there's different things that qualify as a gig, you know, but there are two that come to mind. Both of them were in Conway. I went to college in Conway, Arkansas, just north of Little Rock. We had a beauty pageant, but it was sort of tongue in cheek. It was for men in drag, the Miss Hendrix pageant. And so
in
a bunch
Arkansas.
Of guys dressed, yeah, in Arkansas. We were a little oasis of hedonism and drag dress. So I performed at that. I played No Woman, No Cry. I thought that was fitting. And that was my first performance, was a trio of No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley at a drag show in Conway, Arkansas. And then my first performance where there was an audience there to see somebody. I mean, they weren't there to see me, but I got a gig at a restaurant. My girlfriend at the time had a band, and her band had to cancel this gig at the Breakaway Cafe, I think it was called. And they asked if I could fill in. And so I just had a bunch of cover songs and I sat over there and people were eating their dinner and I played music for them. And it didn't go great, but you know, I got through it. And the next day, the drummer from the band that I filled in for came by the library and he brought me $5 and he handed me a $5 bill. And it was one of the proudest moments of my life. It was, I could not believe that somebody was handing me money for the privilege of getting to play music. And, you know, I don't feel, if somebody gave me $5 for a 90 minute set these days, I would not have the same appreciation. But at that point in my life, it was everything and a really exciting moment for me.
Just easy come, easy go.
It is amazing when you're in college or even younger and you start playing in bands and the concept of getting paid to play music has not even crossed your mind. It's just like your love of getting together with your friends and making music is just everything. You know, I remember we used to sneak into this rehearsal studio at the University of Michigan with our band called The Midnight Special.
It was
blues rock, you know, sloppy frat
house band.
Visualizing
it. Yeah, I got it.
And we figured out that you could jimmy the lock of the biggest rehearsal studio in the basement with our ID cards. And our drummer just kept his drums in there and let anyone who wanted to play them just play them. And we would play for hours and people would gather like on the outside of the dorm and kind of watch us. And it felt like something important was happening, even though it was probably what, 5 or 6 people watching, but like people were gathering to like hear this jangly rock and roll. And we would play various places, the Blind Pig, you know, in Ann Arbor. But we played this like frat alumni event once, and we played for like 5 straight hours. Like, they just were like, keep going, man. And we just repeated our set like 3 times. Like, they were so drunk, they didn't care. And I remember this, you know, 50s middle-aged guy who was like the alumni head just stood on the lawn at the end and just started peeling back $100 bills and gave us like $1,000.
Yeah.
And I was so confused. I was like, you're giving me money like when I'm 19 to play music with my friends?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a thing that people do? You know, and that's why, like, it's intoxicating once you start getting some sort of standing in this world on the road. If a festival in Utah or somewhere else is going to pay you a good chunk of change to play your music under the stars, like, that is an amazing job that you get to do, until it's not, until no one shows up at a club in Cleveland or something.
Right.
And, you know, the hotel's filled with drunks and bed bugs. But I think I wrestle with the idea of, is this life sustainable as, you know, we're all getting older, as I'm going to have a child in January.
Yeah.
It's like, is this like a young man's fantasy, or is this actually something that people can continue doing?
Yeah, I think it's both. It's absolutely a young person's game, and you got to have that dream and that love and that passion to get through those years of sleeping on the floor and making $5 and playing for a tip jar and having your shit get stolen and having nobody come out. Like, if I did not absolutely love it, there's no way I would have gone through that, because if it wasn't an amazing experience, then it would have been the worst thing someone could do in a lot of ways.
Right.
And, you know, you're going to put me in a van and send me all over the country, sleeping in my car or on the porches or whatever shit hotel I can, you know, afford, to play for 4 people who are, you know, often drunk and get my stuff stolen. And so all the negative, you know, be away from my family and, you know, there's so many parts of it. And, you know, I used to do 250 nights a year away from home. Whew. And that was, it's hard to have a good marriage. It's hard to be a good dad. It's hard to have a community of friends. It's hard to be sober and not be a total wreck. And there are people who successfully navigate that. I wasn't necessarily one of them. It was also my dream, and I was as happy as could be in a lot of ways to be able to play music and to watch the growth of a career and people come out and feel the growth of what I was doing as an artist or feel like there was growth there. And that was incredible. But there also was a point for me where, okay, this is probably how I'm going to spend my life. And I think I'm cool with that. I mean, I certainly feel very lucky to have gotten to do it to this point, and I don't take it for granted, but I also need to get my head straight, because I don't feel great. I don't feel healthy. I don't feel settled. I don't have a home life. I don't feel like this is how I'm going to do my next 20 years and be happy with it. And you just have to evolve and kind of like, what are your goals and creatively, what are you trying to do and how do you put that out? Because that's another part of it. I don't want to be singing the same songs in the same way in the same clubs. My wife's also a musician, and she said in an interview the other day, she's kind of really scaled down on the touring and really almost doesn't play at all anymore. And she said, I'm just tired of seeing the same dicks on the wall that I saw 25 years ago. And, you know, as you know, in these dressing rooms and these little rock clubs, a bunch of people drawing genitalia because they think it's cool, you know, when they're 18 or 22 or 25 or whatever. But then, you know, you come back 20 years later and you just want a decent bed and a meal that's not going to give you a heart attack or make you fat. And, just want to have a respectful audience and sing your songs. It's not about pounding a fifth of whiskey and adding to the graffiti and the noise. So it just to me, it's just about gratitude wherever you are on the journey. If it's when you're first starting out, be grateful for that experience. Or if it's trying to hang on, grateful with what you got. But be realistic about it too, because if your heart's not in it or you don't have your head straight, it'll eat you up.
You have a song, I think, that speaks to all of this off of your K-Mag Yo-Yo record in 2011, Hard Out Here, which made me laugh when that line came around. Mom told me to go into easy listening. But I joined a rock and roll band because I thought it'd be cool, but probably should have gone back to school. The lack of backup plan with a lot of us is pretty out there in the open.
I think that's the key for a lot of people, is that lack of backup plan. Yeah. Because we're talking about those early years. If I'd had a job that paid remotely close to six figures, I might have taken it. I mean, this was my passion and I was going to give it a shot, hell or high water. And I was very fortunate to be able to do that. But, I was waiting tables at Chili's while my friends were buying houses. At a certain point, it's you have to question, am I on the right path here? But I didn't have any other option. I was a terrible student. My grades were so low, I couldn't even get back into graduate school to try and get a teacher certificate or something, which, to answer the question I think you were going to ask, is probably what I would have tried to do, is be a teacher of some kind. So I really didn't have any options. So I thought, not only do I love this, but I better make it work. Otherwise, it's not looking good for me.
I guess there must be something I'm missing. My mama told me I should have gone into easy listening, joined up with a band cause I thought it was cool. Oh, probably should have just gone back to school. Oh, pretty darling, it'll be okay. One of these days I'm gonna take you away. She said, oh, sweet daddy, you're probably right. We might get lucky, but it won't.
That was really helped drive me and get through some of those tough times, because I knew it beat my table waiting gig or my ditch digging gig or my medical test patient gig or my house painting gig or all these things that didn't have a much of a future for me as far as doing something that I was going to be really happy with.
How are those baby back ribs at Chili's?
I'm not sure I ever had them, to be honest. It's maybe that's blasphemy of some kind to work there and not know. I don't know. I went to Red Lobster the other day, because I used to work at Red Lobster as well, and I hadn't eaten there in 20 years, and I took the band and kind of as a joke. I just thought, this would be funny. We'll go to Red Lobster. It was awesome. We actually had a great time and the food was delicious. But I worked at a bunch of seafood restaurants and Chili's, Bennigan's, and Red Lobster, and Landry's were the four chains that I worked at. I tended bar and just did all kind of stuff. And it's fun. That's life. You kick around and do whatever you can do to get by. I just feel very fortunate that I was able to take the thing that I loved and turn it into something.
I think you make a good point in that it's kind of sometimes accidental twists of fate that put us into this life, right? Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, you're out there making music as your life, like how courageous and cool, right? But if I wasn't laid off from the advertising job I had in LA when I first got out here, would I have actually taken that chance? Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not like a risk. I'm like, I'm a risk-taking person within reason, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have taken that chance.
Yeah.
Maybe, but you know, I think sometimes the sink or swim situation is really like an important thing for folks. And
it's key. Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between being a hobbyist and being a lifer. Because most people in this, I mean, there's people I know who are incredibly talented and could do anything they wanted or had a great job and gave it up to go play music. But those are the exception rather than the rule, because it's the norm. It's most people who have a steady gig where they can support their family and be home and have a normal life. You know, they may want to learn to play and have fun, but they're not going to go out and do a tour sleeping in the van. There's no reason, there's no need to for them. And that's just not a very appealing life. So there's just very few people that once you have it, that they give it up. And that's one reason why I always feel I have gratitude for where I've been, the opportunities I have, but also that I didn't have a bunch of success early on, because it's also really hard to, you know, if you have a big hit with your first record and you're rolling around in two tour buses, and then 5 years later, you know, 10% of the people are showing up and you can't afford that. And now you got to go down to the minivan, and that would probably be really tough. And a lot of people just give up at that point.
Or you could just stay like we are and just embrace the minivan. Cause I think minivans are underrated personally. The minivan approach, where like one part of the band can go one place and do their thing. The other band can stay at the venue and hang out with their friends and pack up merch. That's sort of been our approach for years.
Yeah.
And it's great, except that right now renting cars, especially minivans or larger SUVs, is really expensive and hard.
Yeah.
Because the microchip shortage or something from China.
Yeah. Well, I drove a minivan for 7 years to tour, and two of them, a Ford Windstar, Oprah Windstar is what I called it. And a tree landed on one. And so I bought the exact same vehicle used. I did that. And then I had a 15 passenger. Which to me was a huge upgrade. It was awesome. And then about 10 years ago, I got a Sprinter and been driving that. And I just sold it today. Actually, I just found out today that it was sold. And yeah, I'm going out on tour in 2 weeks, and I'm renting two Suburbans. And yeah, I had a bus lined up for the first time in my career. I was going to take a bus, and then the pandemic just kind of made that not financially a good decision. So I gave it back and just going to rent some cars. But yeah, I mean, the point is, wherever you're at, it's easier to see those incremental upgrades and go, okay, right. I feel a little better now than to have all the success in the world and then it just disappear. And you have to deal with that reality. Okay, I'm going out, but my career is on the trajectory is the wrong way. And maybe creatively I got used to certain things because I had all the success and I played to that. And now those fans are gone and I'm left with nothing. I don't have the creative thing. I don't have whatever. So the beauty of not having hits or not having fans is you do your own thing and you can be true to yourself. And then when people come to that, they're there for the right reasons. And it's, it can be a tough slog, but there's an integrity to that, I think, and a value to that.
I can see you working a late shift at Red Lobster, a little beaten down, trying to like keep your creative flow going, writing a song like She Left Me for Jesus, like in the back break room or something, right. You know, the idea of this like woman telling you, you know, I found this perfect man, you know. He's ripped. He's just really like got a great smile
and great cheekbones.
Got his whole life figured out. His name is Jesus.
We've been dating since high school. We never once left this town. We used to go out on the weekends. And we drank till we drown. But now she's acting funny. And I don't understand. I think that she's found some other man.
it's like a great country line, honestly, like country music hook. But again, would that be accepted on the Nashville Power 100, whatever? God, probably not.
No, absolutely not. No. But it did find a home, you know, in a lot of different places. And it's funny that when that song came out, She Loved Me for Jesus, it was my first release. I signed a major label deal with Lost Highway Records, who was part of Universal. And the two records before that had been sort of independent releases. And so now all of a sudden I'm on this label with Willie Nelson and Ryan Adams and Lucinda Williams and Elvis Costello and Van Morrison and I love it, like all these heroes. It was incredible. And I felt a lot of pressure and made this record. And then the first song that comes out is She Loved Me for Jesus and iTunes. This is in 07, I think. I mean, iTunes was a huge deal. That was kind of where everybody was going for their digital music. And they used to have this thing called the free giveaway or song of the day giveaway, where they would pick a song for the week and it was free. There was a free preview and it was a huge coup. And we got it for She Loved Me for Jesus. And the record label was ecstatic. And I went and listened to the clip. They played a 15-second clip or 10-second clip. And that all that it was, if I ever find Jesus, I'm kicking his ass. No context, you know, no getting the joke or the satire or the setup. And that was it. And the whole world's listening to this thing. And I thought, oh, this is going to be bad. She left me for Jesus. And it turned out it was the lowest rated song in the history of the iTunes giveaway. It had like a 1-star rating because everybody, millions of not only country fans, but like hip hop fans, everybody that, you know, listen to music, that's where you would go. And they're just like 1-star. So anyway, but it did go on to turn a lot of people and found me a lot of champions and people that really appreciated what we were trying to do and help spread the word. So I have a mixed kind of relationship with that song because it is campy and it's parody and I didn't want to be identified. I didn't want that to be my dead skunk in the middle of the road or up against the wall, redneck mother, or this song that I could not live down. And I was really afraid of that. And so I put it 14th on the record and I didn't play it live. And I was trying to do everything to not be identified with it. But at the end of the day, it brought a lot of people into the camp and turned people onto what I do. And so I'm grateful for it. But I remember writing it and Ray Wiley Hubbard said to me, he said, "Hey, once the cat's out of the bag, it's real hard to get back in." And I was afraid that it would take on a life and I would have to carry that, which is a weird thing to put out music and hope that people don't love it. But with that one song, I sort of had that feeling about it.
Well, I think songs we write become bigger than us, right? They become entities in the world that.
Yeah, you don't have control over them once they're out there.
Hate. They have relationships with this music, right? Yeah. And I've always had this struggle with our group Dust Bowl Revival in writing fun, like punchline songs with like maybe cheesy or goofy, crude type lines, right? This song with a lampshade on we wrote years ago about just getting drunk and putting a lampshade on your head and going crazy at a party sort of became like this mascot that we couldn't control. It had a dance move. People would bring lampshades to every show. Like little kids are singing it. It's about like getting blackout drunk, which I've never done in my life, but we wrote it as a joke. Most of the guys in the band were like, "Can we just never play this song again?" But it would crush so hard as the finale that we like had to do it, you know? Yeah. And now we kind of bring it back as like a medley within another song as like an ironic, like wink or something.
Yeah.
And it feels great. Like it feels like, hey, this is like something you wrote years ago that means something to people. It's about letting loose and just being who you are, you know, and let that be enough. You know, maybe you don't have to judge yourself so harshly, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, I know I took myself very seriously, and I think there was just a real fear of something like that. Like I love silly, goofy songs. Like I said, I love humor, but I also love the way that Towns could move me. I loved the way that Willie Nelson could articulate a feeling. I loved the way that the stories Prine told or the perspective they put on life. And I wanted to be able to do all those things.
Well, jumping ahead, you know, you've been doing this for, you know, two decades. There's a certain maturity, a certain acceptance that I think I can hear in your music now. The new record, You Get It All, was produced by Kenny Greenberg and your wife, Allison Moore, who's an amazing musician in her own right. And I think there's a real depth and kind of slowness to some of the songs, like a slow burn where you're not trying to observe everything passing your window, right? It's like honing in on an idea, like in the song Different Boats, for example, which I think is my favorite track on this. It feels like a lost Pink Floyd number for me, with this sort of funky drone guitar line and the idea that some people are going one way, some people are going the other way, and we're both going to get to the same place in our own sweet time. Kind of reminiscent of what Robert Plant has done in his later years with Alison Krauss. This synthesis of, I think, blues and folk music and having these very deep ideas about where we end up in life, where we go when we die, maybe, you know, will we be judged on the other side? And, you know, we're all on the same river. We just are getting to the end at different points.
Some stay in the shallow, some get in the deep. Some are slow and lazy, others up a creek, others up a creek. You know what that means? We get what we are given, and hope that it floats. Everybody's on the river, just taking different boats.
That one just sort of came, it was one of the first songs I wrote with my wife. We were taking a trip to Nashville, I can't remember why, but we just kind of started an exercise of, I think I was lamenting not writing much. And we said, well, let's just write a song today and make it happen. And so we started it, and I don't even remember how it originated, but that idea of yeah, we are all on the same trip. You know, we just have different ways of getting there. And, you know, I'll try not to judge yours and you try not to judge mine. And let's just not be assholes to each other. We're all going to die. Might as well be good, but have fun. And fill in whatever you want into there. But the river is the metaphor for life. And we're all on that river until we're not. And but yeah, that you mentioned the sort of the pace and the slowness of it. And when I listen to this record, to me, that's the noticeable thing is with the exception, I think, of one song, most of the things are very calm. And I don't mean like there's an energy and there's an excitement, but the pace of those songs for me as a singer, I'm surprised. I've been playing them live lately in the band. Every time we go, we start and we're like, whoa, this is too fast. And we have to slow down and slow down. And what I realize is that in the studio, we really came in with a confidence and some space, allowed these songs to breathe. And so there's still an energy there, but those lyrics just can live there and stand. And I don't have to Chuck Berry it like I did in my earlier days. I would always, you know, the rapid fire, and I just got to get as many noises and sounds and words in here as I can and not let people have a minute to think. I think there's a confidence that comes with having done it for that many years and made that many records. And working with Kenny and Allison, they really kind of reminded me of that. Like, you know, I was singing well. I think this is the best I've ever sung on a record. And I feel like the songs are really strong. So just letting that be enough. There's an old anecdote, which I don't know if it's true or not, but and I don't know what the cursing situation is on this.
Please curse.
Okay. Carol Kay, the famous bass player.
The Wrecking Crew.
Wrecking Crew. Saw a guy, I can't remember who it was, but saw somebody playing guitar, and they're just, you know, a million notes. Just got to get it all in there, right? And afterwards, she sees the guy. She says, "Kid, I hope you don't fuck like you play guitar." You know, I think when you're younger, or at least for me, the tendency is to show all your tricks at once. And I don't feel the need to do that as much these days. So I appreciate the pace of the record. It feels more confident to me.
You wrote a song with Josh Morningstar called Help Me Remember on the new record about Alzheimer's and dementia and people sort of slipping away from their family and their loved ones. Have you experienced that in your own life? And how did you decide to tackle that really tough subject?
Yeah, I have. My grandfather, my father's father, started to show signs of it before he died. Fortunately, he passed before it became completely debilitating. But I was 14 or 15. I was with him in Waco, Texas, where he lived. And there were two incidents that stood out to me. One was he was really sweet, loving, friendly guy, but he was just being real critical of me one day and not kind. And I remember my dad telling me, he said, "Don't remember your grandfather this way. This is not who he was." Right. He's struggling. And then the second instance was we were driving in his pickup through town, and I didn't live in Waco. I was just visiting from Houston. And we came to a stoplight and it turned green and he asked me where we were. And I don't know. Like I don't know where we are. And he had lived in this place for most of his life.
Right.
And it just had disappeared on him. He didn't know where he was. And it was really scary. He passed about a year after that.
I say, baby, I'm scared and I'm not sure I know who I am. Can you help me remember who it is that I used to be? Can you tell me the story of my family, my hopes and my dreams? Did I try to stand for something? What I always fold, did I do things when I was young to be proud of when I was old? Was our house on fire, or was I just a slow burning ember? Could you please help me remember?
You know, you're witness of your life. Like, we all go through life and our friends die, our family dies, and the people who saw you at your best, they saw you during your triumphs and your peaks and your lows, and they know that story. Those people are, you know, some people don't have those people, and some people have lots of them, but they disappear over time. And so I was thinking about to a partner, to a spouse, somebody who's having a hard time remembering their own story, and just how important it is to have that person who can remind you. Because at a certain point, you know, your kids are your kids, and that's one thing, but they're never going to know what it was like to fall in love with their mom, or to you know, to have your 20s or 30s, or what it was like to be a parent to them. Or there's certain things that only your partner can know, or only your really close friends that were there in that time of life can know. And so I wanted to write a song about that, and ended up thinking, reminding my grandfather, and making about someone who's losing the thread and having a hard time remembering their own life, and pleading with their spouse to fill in those blanks for them.
Help me remember. I need you to help me remember.
I want to take us out with a song that you wrote with Brandi Clark called In the Meantime. I think maybe it was a tough song to write, just about how we can really damage the people around us without knowing it.
I was thinking about my own marriage, and I know a lot of people probably have this, is you can be having the best of times, and then something can happen and you can end up in the ditch. And we have our traumas, you know, we have our triggers and our scars and our things that, when that gets triggered, it can, our defenses go up and we're not empathetic or loving or open. We're scared and wounded and defensive, and some real damage can be done to people that you love. And that can be a really scary time, and just to, you know, kind of can hang on and pray and hope you get through it. So that was the idea. I was just thinking about that and trying to articulate it in a song. And I had that hook, that title, In the Meantime, the two separate words, like, which was a trick that I always love from country music, often is like On the Other Hand, or there's some great classic country songs. So yeah, it was, I took that to Brandi, just that idea. And she's an incredible songwriter. I'm a huge fan of hers. And we started working on it. It took a while. It was one of those that we started writing it and then took a year off and then got back together and finished it up. And originally I was just thinking about it being one person's song, but then I thought, well, I've written this with not only is she a great songwriter, but she's a fantastic singer and an artist. Why don't we see if we can make it a duet? And so I invited her, and she fortunately she said yes and came in and sang it.
The good times we've had, the smiles and the laughs are the pictures that fill up these frames, that hang in the halls and cover the walls of the home where we spend our days. Most times, those good times are the times that we're in. And even the tough times we'd walk through again. But in the meantime, the holler and scream time, the crush all your forgotten and hope falls behind.
So it was one that was, it took some time, but it was a fun thing to craft. I mean, even though it was kind of challenging subject matter, it was something I felt like I knew well, and I knew what I wanted to say. It was just a matter of crafting it to get it to say that thing, which I think we ultimately did.
All right, let's say you can make one last album before you die, but you have the ability to do a duets record with five people dead or alive at any point in history. Who would those five duets be with?
Oh, man. That's well, I'm going to go ahead and throw Willie on the list. I would love to sing or have song with Willie Nelson. I think that would be, I just would love to have that experience. Boy, duets record. I don't know. I have artists I love, but whether, you know, would Townsend and I do great singing on a record together? Probably not.
So this is a fantasy question.
Yeah. Sorry. I got to take it all literally. You know, this is sort of a wild card in a recent edition, but I went two nights ago and saw Gregory Alan Isaacoff and Patty Griffin do a show. And if you'd asked me going into that, I'm a big Patty fan and that just one of America's great voices. But there was something about Gregory's show that just triggered me. I've got this whole batch of songs that I've been working on that I just have voice memos on and just some ideas. And I saw him singing and the way he set it up, I said, I want to do this record with him. I haven't told anybody this. I haven't even told my wife this, but so I'm just telling you right now. And I got to figure out a way to pitch it to Gregory and prepare myself for rejection. But there's something about the way he plays and sings that I thought this would be a really cool project. And I have all these ideas that I would love to run by him and work with him on.
It's all right. Honey, it's alright. It's alright to be alone.
Yeah, let's I think Dylan and I need to do a duet. I think maybe Lucinda and I should have sang together on a record, Lucinda Williams. Let's go ahead and throw Bob Marley in there. That would be a really weird pairing, but what the hell. And
you can always bring back No Woman No Cry at a drag show in Arkansas, you know, just go back and recreate that.
I remember I played it once for a friend, and I was probably 21, and she goes, it's good, but you sound so white. I was like, yeah, I'm not Jamaican, I'm Texan. I don't know, Ray Charles. Let's go Ray Charles, and that'll, right. I think that gets me into five, doesn't it?
I would see that tour.
He wouldn't.
Touché.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm really excited for people to hear this new record, and I appreciate you getting on the line with me here.
Well, it's good talking to you, and I've been exploring your music as well, and I really appreciate and enjoy what you guys do. So cool. I hope our paths cross on the road one of these days.
All my tame and all my wild, all my man and all my child, all my faults and all my scars, all my sometimes lucky stars, all my joys and my regrets, all my old Guy Clark cassettes. I knew the night we met, you get it all.
There you go. Big thanks to Hayes Carl for talking to me. You can go to hayescarl.com. That's Carl, CARLL.com. And his newest record, You Get It All, is out now on Dual Tone Records. He has some really cool tour dates coming up. If you're in Nashville, he'll be playing the Basement East with friend of the show Caroline Spence, November 18th, playing the Grand Ole Opry the 19th, the Bluebird the 20th,
lots of cool stuff down there, and he'll be playing in Austin and in Lubbock and in Fort Worth, Houston, his hometown, very soon in December. So check it out, HayesCarl.com. If you head over to our mothership, thebluegrasssituation.com, you'll see that back on November 2nd, they did a really cool piece about his animated video for Nice Things, that is the rockin' country opener of the new record. In his own words, he says, "We've been given the gift of a beautiful planet that most of us pollute without a thought and generally don't respect. We've criminalized things that grow naturally on it while pushing dangerous chemicals into our food, water, and medicine." These are things that a mainstream country artist would not say, and that's why I love the country music that Hayes makes. As you can hear, my voice is still recovering from the 2.5-week tour that my group Dust Bowl Revival just came back from. Please don't miss the final two shows with our friend Smooth Hound Smith coming up December 2nd at the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix, Arizona, and December 4th, the homecoming show, The Troubadour, Los Angeles. It is almost sold out. Please get those tickets now. And last but not least, December 31st, New Year's Eve, we will be opening for Railroad Earth at the Fillmore Auditorium in Denver. Please check that out, dustbowlrevival.com, for more. Look, if you dig this podcast, or any podcast really, what you can do to help us grow is tell your friends about us and leave us a review on the podcast's page on Apple. It really helps spread the word, and we'll have really cool new episodes coming next year, including my talk with Grammy winner Keb Moe and the amazing St. Paul and the Broken Bones. TheShowOnTheRoad.com/episodes for all our episodes going back 3 straight years. And if you go on our YouTube channel, you'll see entire unedited interviews with me talking to folks like Ani DeFranco. Indeed, I spend days making these conversations flow a little bit faster. But with Ani, I think it's actually worth it to see what she's saying in its entirety. She is brilliant, and it's worth watching. As always, The Show on the Road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitan, with associate producer Taylor Kaufman. Stay safe, get vaccinated, and we'll see you on the trail.